The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Just a little bit from last time. I won't say too much about the Polyakov work on cortex, but you'll notice that, like Meslem, he has three kinds of cortex, except that his third kind, which is, he says, is the most advanced area of cognitive functions, he includes a lot more. This area in human would include a lot of Meslem's unimodal visual association cortex. That's the major difference. And the other thing to note is that just like most other people, they indicate that that most advanced cortex doesn't exist in rats, and hedgehogs, and similar animals. Very little even in the dog. But remember what we said about that most advanced, the area where our highest functions where are localized, they are the multimodal association areas, which we postulated that multimodal cortex is the most primitive cortex, but it's the area that has expanded the most in the more special, you know, the brain becomes more and more compartmentalized and specialized with evolution. Human brains are probably the most compartmentalized, most specialized of all the animals. All right. A little more about these that comes out of that Moscow work and some other topics. First of all, the postnatal growth of different territories. He shows the amount of postnatal growth on the ordinate here, and he's just studied that, made measures for different regions of cortex. And just note here that the first four bars are all multimodal association areas. F means, he says frontal areas, but he means the prefrontal cortex. Middle, temporal, inferior parietal, and the temporal parietal occipital area, that's an area in between the, its multimodal cortex in the area Wernicke's area. Okay. And the second thing then is myelinogenesis, and, this is the picture from Cecil and Oscar Vogt, who studied that, and the areas to get their myelin first are in the heavy dots, and the light dots are the areas to acquire myelin last, and you see that the multimodal association areas tend to be the areas that have expanded the most postnatally and are areas where we've been localizing the highest functions in humans. Tend to myelinate late. There are some exceptions in the limbic areas. Right? And this is from the work of Paul Flechsig. The numbers here in his pictures don't represent Brodmann areas. Okay, the numbers represent the order of appearance. So number one is the first place he saw myelin appearing. Number 45 is the last place. 45 here in the lateral prefrontal area in humans. And you see the early numbers in the primary visual area, primary sensory and motor areas, primary auditory areas, they all myelinate very early. And you saw pictures of that way back in when we were doing chapter 6 when I showed up a picture from the work of Flechsig, a photograph of one of his sections of the human brain, a horizontal section. Okay, and this is just the growth of the thickness of the association layers, layers 2 and 3. Or no, sorry, this is just layer 3. And here's prenatal growth of these 5 different areas, and I pointed out what they are, frontal eye fields, prefrontal cortex, and the Broca's area. So they're all in the frontal lobe. And just note here that these areas are still becoming thicker even after age 15. Okay? He just has 15 and then he just put the rest of them into the adult category. So they're not completely finished growing even in the mid-teens. So I said 15, no, it's 12 years. Okay. And then I just want to mention Larry Benowitz studies of these areas, like areas, layers 2 and 3. That's where he found the protein that is often referred to as the growth-associated protein because it's present in axons during early development. All axons have a lot of growth-associated protein. It seems to be correlated with periods when processes have these filipodia extending. Growing axons always have those. I've studied it with Larry Benowitz in the hamster optic tract, for example. And we found that it's located all along the axon very early. And then when the arborization is occurring in the tectum and geniculate body, the gap 43 becomes localized to the terminal region and then declines after the maturation of the axons. But even in adult humans, Larry finds that protein localized in these association layers areas, and those are the very areas that have been found by Ellie, and now other people are confirming that throughout the cortex they find, if they look with modern imaging techniques and can image cells over an extended period of time, they see remodeling happening, a lot of changes. So we think that those many small neurons, many interneurons, mostly GABAergic interneurons. And whenever they've tried to localize the cell type, they find that there are these GABA-containing interneurons. The very neurons that didn't, most of which don't originate in neocortex. In the neocortical ventricular layer, they originate in other areas. Okay, we don't have time to talk about dominant and non-dominant hemispheres. I just want to point out that they are anatomically a little bit different. And sometimes the differences are rather large, like in the area around the auditory cortex, areas related to understanding of speech and production of speech. And that work was done right here in Boston when Norman Geschwind, the famous behavioral neurologist, was still alive. His associate, Al Galliberta, did those studies, and he's still working at the Beth Israel Hospital. The ideas on thalamic evolution, I'm just going to let you read. I've gone over them before, and I just summarized them in these two slides. Okay, I want to go on and talk about development and plasticity in the neocortex. We talked about one thing first, very relevant to this topic. This just came out fairly recently, February 27th issue of Cell. Neurogenesis in the striatum of the adult human brain. Here's what they did. They used carbon-14, natural labeling of humans exposed to carbon-14 due to atomic testing. Okay, so they're eating foods and so forth. So they get newly generated neurons end up being labeled with carbon-14 if they have some sensitive measures to find them. They can get measures of neurogenesis, and they can see that rostral migratory stream that we know from the studies of rodents migrates into the olfactory bulbs, and that's why you get turnover of the small granule cells, the most numerous cell type in the olfactory bulb. About I think it's around 40-day period. They could turn over completely. There's a lot of generation. And then, this study says that in humans, those cells get diverted into the striatum. In the rodent, they go right past the striatum. They're generated in the lateral ventricle, the ventricular layer there, around the lateral ventricle. But these don't continue into the olfactory bulb. It wasn't clear to me, I've not even completely read every detail of the article, it's not clear whether any of them get into the olfactory bulb in humans. That would be a big surprise if that were true, but it's a fascinating finding if it can be confirmed in other labs, because it would indicate that in each of the two major forebrain systems for learning that we've talked about in this class, the hippocampus and the corpus striatum, and that includes for learning both dorsal and ventral striatum, he talks as if the new neurons are all going into dorsal striatum. I'm not sure that that will turn out to be true. But the point is, new neurons are going right into the striatum in humans. And, of course, now we have to look carefully to see if there's none of them go into the striatum in other animals. I would suspect that other very large animals, they probably do, but so far we only know it about human, because the studies have not, just haven't been done yet. Sorry? Yeah. The carbon-14 data dating was done when they were alive, naturally, because they were exposed to the fallout contains carbon-14, right?
Yes.
Natural experiment. Unnatural, actually, but because it's atomic testing. Yes? Very, very interesting question. Could the exposure to radioactivity itself cause some abnormalities? We don't think so because the levels are very low. Okay? But it's still an interesting question, and one I hope it leads to a lot more work, because we've only recently seen a lot of work on hippocampal turnover and its relationship to learning. Okay, we know that animals that are learning a lot and exposed to enriched environments do generate more cells. And we know that stress reduces cell turnover. All right. So when we talked about development, we had these four major events, neurulation, formation, and the formation of the neural tube, that is, formation of the neural plate and then the neural tube, and then proliferation of cells, and then migration, and finally the growth of axons and dendrites that we call the differentiation of the cell, the adult cell. Okay, so these are the questions here. First of all, what is the subpeal granular layer? When we talked about proliferation, we talked about cells dividing in the cell cycle. You see them synthesizing DNA here and then splitting into two. And they split in one of two ways, either symmetrically or asymmetrically, and that had different consequences because proteins are not distributed the same throughout the cell. Proteins tend, like NUM, tend to be distributed differently and near the ventricle and away from the ventricle. So if they split asymmetrically, they tend to have much more that protein in just part of the cell. So the ones that are further from the ventricle become postmitotic. They migrate away towards their, migrate to their adult locations, and the ones that, the others stay mitotic until the end of the period of proliferation. Okay, but what is the subpeal granular layer? You could say they're granule cells. They're the generating cells at the ventricle, the very small cells. That's why we call them granule. The subpeal granular layer, you may know, exists in the cerebellum of all the animals that have been studied. Cells migrate from the rhombic lip area of the hindbrain, the inner plate of the hindbrain. They migrate up into the cerebellar cortex. But then they keep dividing right under the pia. And the cells that are generated in the pia then migrate down into the cerebellar cortex and form the granule cells of the cerebellar cortex. Well, apparently in larger brained animals, animals that have a lot of neocortex, okay, again, there's really numerous small cells, granule cells in the cortex. And the larger the brain, the more of them there are. They develop this transient generative layer below the pia. It certain parts of the brain. And that's the subpial granular layer. It's not present in the lab animals we normally use. Okay? It's not present in the mice and the rats and hamsters. Okay? Now, these two types of cell division were related by Rakic. This just says what I talked about. This is one of Rakic's illustrations, but he pointed out that the period of symmetric and also of asymmetric cell division in the monkey the periods are shorter than in humans. He said that even, you know, one additional symmetrical cell division which should result in a larger cortex. And the human, just by continuing several more days, is going to end up with a much larger cortex. And we know this is under genetic control. What about asymmetric cell division? What should happen then? Well, what should happen is, you look at his picture here. Here's the ventricle down here. Here it is in the cell stain. So the cells are generated in the ventricular and then also the subventricular layer. Okay, and the ones that are migrating due to asymmetric cell division, as more continue to be generated by the stem cells down here, you can have many cells moving, as he shows here, many cells moving along the same radial glial cell up into the cortical plate. So the more asymmetric cell division there is, the thicker the cortex should become. And the human cortex is considerably thicker than the monkey. And we have a longer period of asymmetric cell division. Okay, this just illustrates these periods. And I summarize it here. And he wrote about that back in 95, in Trends in Neuroscience. And I show pictures, one from Rakic, the monkey, only the earlier periods, where you see these different layers designated, ventricular and subventricular zones, where the mitoses are occurring. And then an intermediate zone, where there are migrating cells, but they don't stay there. So that becomes the layer of the white matter. And then there's a subplate layer and a cortical plate. The cortical plate is where the cells collect. And we normally call it the cortical plate in the period when you can differentiate different layers. He shows some of them beginning to differentiate here and many of them not differentiating. And then at the top, mostly processes, just a few neurons. We call that the marginal zone. And then he's got in parentheses here, the subpial granular layer. That's what SG is. Okay, and then this is from our work, work I did with Janice Nagley and her PhD work, where we're showing postnatal day 1, postnatal day 5, and an adult hamster. And labeling those same things. Except there's no obvious subventricular layer in the hamster. Animals with a larger cortex tend to develop that. And notice here at postnatal day 5, there's a layer 5 and 6 that have differentiated, so you can identify them, but above that, we just call it the cortical plate because you can't see separate layers 2, 3, and 4. And here's the adult. You can see all the layers. All right. So what do we mean by we looked at that picture of migration. What do we mean by the inside-out pattern of migration? It has to do with when cells undergo their final mitosis, okay, and migrate. That's the birthday of the cell. We don't say they're born yet when they're just generating. Okay, it's only when they become post-mitotic and they migrate. We say that's the birth date when they finish mitosis. Okay, and the inside-out pattern This is the picture we were looking at. This is from the study at Harvard when Pashko Rock teaches at Harvard. And he had a very good technician that had come here from Vietnam, a Vietnamese couple that I helped in getting settled here. And then I found her a job with Pashko Rakic. She did this fantastic work with him where they labeled cells in the monkey by injecting the uterus of the mother at various stages. So here you see this is E40. So this is about E45. And when they injected the tritiated thymidine at E45 and then waited until the animal's cortex differentiated, they found the labeled cells here at the bottom of layer 6. Okay? If they waited much longer here to embryonic day 90, all the cells that were labeled are up here in layers 2 and 3. And in between, you have this pattern. Earliest born cells end up at the bottom. The later born cells then have to migrate past the others. So they're generated from this is inside near the ventricle. This is outside near the pia. Okay? So that's the inside-out pattern. That's all we mean by it. And the same thing has been discovered and was known earlier from the rodent work, where they used other methods of labeling initially. But it's also been done with tritiated thymidine for labeling the cells at their last birthday. And there's other methods of labeling, too, that you can use. So what are the other proliferative zones other than the ventricular zone? We've mentioned them before. We talked about it mainly way back in chapter 12, where there's some illustrations, two illustrations there towards the end of the chapter. One of them is from Rakic, where he summarizes the primate compared with a rodent. And the other picture is another summary from work on cells that aren't born in the ventricular layer in the rodent. And remember where they come from? We had just been talking about Harvey Carton's hypothesis that the dorsal ventricular ridge cells migrate very differently in mammals and in birds. Hypothesis that has been largely supported. But basically, the small GABAergic interneurons of the cortex come mainly from the striatal area, the area that is in the position of the striatum. It's called the ganglionic eminence in humans. And in rodents, there's a very clear medial ganglionic eminence and lateral ganglionic eminence. Most of them come from the medial one, but they come from the lateral one also. And for the posterior parts of the hemisphere, it's just one ganglionic eminence, so they call it the caudal ganglionic eminence. But the ganglionic eminence region gives rise to most of these interneurons. These are the chapter 12 pages. Okay, and then I want you to be a little bit familiar with the Finlay and Darlington publication of how structures change in size in different species largely as a function of the total brain size. In other words, the degree of concerted evolution rather than mosaic evolution is considerable. And I asked you how they actually do their plots. We'll just look at that. The question really is, how much does the neocortex grow in with regard to the whole brain in various mammalian species? And you can ask, does the rest of the brain grow proportionately? Basically, it seems to. In these plots, on the ordinate, they take the logarithm of the size, the volume of a structure, like neocortex, or striatum, or hippocampus down there. Here's the medulla oblongata. Here's the paleocortex down here. Here's the septal area. And they plot it against a logarithm of the size of the entire brain. Okay. Now remember, these are logarithmic plots, and they're taking, like for neocortex, the entire neocortex. And they see the degree of concerted evolution. As the brain grows in size, so do all these structures grow in size. But note that neocortex is growing more, and if you plot it on a linear scale, and look at the left here, this is still the log plot on the abscissa, but here on the ordinate in this 3D picture, you see the huge amount of increase in size of the neocortex. That can sometimes be missed when you look at a picture like this. This is very, very large compared to this because of the logarithmic scale. Okay, but notice also that there are the different colors are for different groups. Note here for the insectivores, the size of neocortex, the relative size, falls below the curve for other groups. And for insectivores again, for the paleocortex, that is the olfactory cortex, it actually is a little larger in relative terms compared to other animals. But still, you'd have to say there's considerable concerted evolution. But remember that when you deal with the neocortex, the different parts of the neocortex, this says nothing about it, because there's tremendous variation in relative size of different parts of the cortex. And this would say nothing at all about that. The other part of their analysis was an interesting one. They did factor analysis to look at what correlates with these differences in size of these different structures. They found that two factors, one represented by the blue bars, one represented by the orange bars, and you're looking at the amount of the variance explained. That's what factor analysis does. And you'll note, this is the summary here, the blue bars there indicate that one factor accounts for over 96% of the total variance. It's highly correlated with neocortical size, least correlated with olfactory bulb size. A second factor accounts for 3%, leaving only 1%. It's most highly correlated with the olfactory bulbs, and next with limbic system structures, not correlated with neocortex size. So there appears to them to have been much more mosaic evolution in the olfactory and limbic system structures. We already know that how relatively huge the olfactory bulbs are in rodents compared with primates. And this is just one example. That's just one example of this. All right. A little bit about nature and nurture and the formation of cortex. We want to know how the cortex gets specified into its different areas. And before there was very much genetic work, there was a lot of argument about whether there was genetic determination of the different areas. And it took a long time to get enough data because there were other possible explanations, just the pattern of axon connections could explain a lot. Axons come in from the thalamus in a organized way, and they distribute according to the way they're organized in the internal capsule. And that could have, if their terminations then resulted in differentiation of the cortex differently depending on what inputs they were getting, that could account for quite a bit. But the evidence for a genetically determined map has been the most supported. Epigenetic fact, but as we know, in every nature-nurture issue, it's almost always both. And so there's a lot of evidence for the effects of of experience of various sorts as well. But basically, the more and more cortical areas, we do have specific genes that are active during their development. Okay. The first one was work by Pat Leavitt, who discovered this limbic-associated membrane protein. And then there's been interesting studies of using transplants, like if they took some limbic cortex that had this protein and they transplanted it to somatosensory cortex, the fate, it didn't become somatosensory cortex, it became stayed limbic cortex. But the result depended on the age. If you do it before embryonic day 12, before this protein start to be expressed, before that gene was expressed and that protein was formed, then it just becomes somatosensory cortex. Similar work was done in the rat between visual area and somatosensory areas. You take a little bit of visual cortex and put it in somatosensory cortex. And it becomes somatosensory cortex if you do it real early, but if you do it too late, it doesn't become somatosensory cortex. It keeps its specificity. Okay, so what about the epigenetic factors like activity? And the visual system's been used for a lot of this, and I want to know here about an example of how neuronal activity can affect the development of axon connections even when the activity is prenatal. So you think of vision, well, it must start after birth, right? What can an embryo in the womb see? Well, it's making a big assumption that activity always depends on open eyes, and that's in fact was found out to be true in Carla Schatz's lab. She gave a talk here just recently. She's continued to work on these issues. And with her work with Meister, Wong, and Baylor, they discovered these waves of activity. This is a little schematic of the retina that she's repeated, showing it at different times. She's plotted the time here. And you see the activity beginning here, and then it moves right across the retina to the other side. And this is happening well before birth. And she found that, in fact, that activity plays an important role in the formation of precise topographic and organized connections. Topography isn't determined by this activity, but how precise the axons are terminating is affected by it. And that was the first discovery of this. That same effects of activity had been worked on for some time in the lab where Carla was, the Hubel lab. She was David Hubel's graduate student. The study of binocular connections. We've talked about the ocular dominant stripes in the cortex. These are just plots of relative response of single neurons to input from one eye versus the other eye. One eye on one side, the other eye on the other side, and then many neurons get input from both eyes. You see how the neonate is different, and if you monocularly deprive the animal, this is usually done with cats, then the occluded eye, you end up with very few cells. When you open the eye and stimulate it, very few cells now can respond at all to the occluded eye, whereas the open eye, most of the cells are responding. So the connections must be changing. And this is basically a picture to summarize that, where you see the diagram here, just illustrating two layers, rather than all the layers, just to indicate the layers that respond to one eye versus the layers that respond to the other eye. And you see how early in development they just overlap in the cortex. They go to the right place topographically, but they just overlap with each other, right eye and left eye. And they end up then segregating over time. If you block activity, they don't segregate. Okay? You can completely block activity simply by blocking action potentials, with tetrodotoxin and something like that. They stay completely overlapped. If you get unequal activity in the two eyes, like patch one eye, then you end up with wider stripes for the stimulated eye and narrower stripes for the other eye. And that causes, it happens in strabismic individuals. They can end up with using one eye much more than the other eye, and the eye that they're not using very much will have much lower acuity. Because acuity depends on the amount of cortex devoted to the sensory surface. And this just shows you what's happening to the axons. These are in kittens. This is in layer 4, and so this is presumably a thalamocortical axon. It has all the characteristics of a thalamocortical axon terminating in layer 4. Bottom of 3, and you see it's a very dense, widespread terminal arbor, but if you look in adults, this is one axon terminating in two different ocular dominance stripes. And that's what happens with the activity of development in a normal adult cat. And here's the effects of deprivation. This happens after just a few weeks. Here you have the non-deprived eye, axons representing the non-deprived eye. Here's the deprived eye, where the axons just don't develop so much. Okay. That's long-term. Short-term, and I think here they got down to around a week, but maybe it was up to 2 weeks. These are all after months. I said weeks, but these were longer than that. These are the short-term ones, but you see they're getting the same effects even after the shorter time. So it's happening pretty rapidly. We think the connections made by these axons are consolidated by the activity they generate and their ability to fire the action potentials in the cells. I think that Hebb's rule, cells that are firing together, they wire together, seems to explain a lot of what's going on, and we know there are many molecular studies of this in recent years. There's other paradigms that have been used to study this. One is alter the wiring diagram by early brain lesions. I was able to do that pretty early using hamsters, but the hamsters are more difficult to do the physiological studies. So then it started being done on ferrets and other animals. The ferret was particularly good because it's born in a pretty immature state before the retinal projections are fully mature. And this was done by Mrigank Assur and his students. And here, he shows what happens if you just remove the inferior colliculus and superior colliculus. So the axons are pruned and they're deprived, the thalamus is deprived of its normal, a large auditory projection from the inferior colliculus. What happens is axons of the optic tract that are passing over the medial geniculate will grow into the medial geniculate and terminate. So that means you would expect a visually responsive area in the auditory cortex, and that's what they found by recording. And they mapped it. Here's the auditory area. The visual area would be way up here. The auditory cortex now forms a topographic map of the visual field. It's not quite as precise as normal, but it's there. And then when they looked at unit properties, selective response to contours of different orientation, they found that that existed too. Again, it was a little more sloppy, the tuning, but it was pretty good tuning. We also know that the brain changes after blinding. This is from a study of the short-tailed possum. This is the normal, where you see the visual areas here. auditory areas and somatosensory areas, getting mostly unimodal input with some multimodal areas here in between. Now remember, they're saying they're unimodal, and most likely there's some multimodal input, but look what happens if you blind them early. You get throughout the visual and areas around auditory and somatosensory. It's all multimodal. They were looking at the remaining somatosensory and auditory modalities, and they were getting cells responding to both modalities in all of this cortex. And even in the primary auditory cortex, they were getting somatosensory units now. And within somatosensory cortex, they were getting some auditory responses too. So it's an amazing change. And there is other data on humans as well as on rats indicating that visual cortex takes on other functions after blinding. Okay, it's learned and used by rats, for example, in solving mazes. Blind rats are using visual cortex to help them solve mazes. And this kind of data indicates that that's not surprising considering what's happening. A possible explanation is that normally there are very precise connections, as I've argued before, that are multimodal, just not, they're sparse, and they might be too sparse to actually drive the cells to trigger action potentials. But when they increase, when the normal input is gone, they could increase in strength. We call that the silent synapse hypothesis, where the once silent synapses suddenly become active, probably because they're sprouting, they're increasing in their strength. There are experiments now with mature monkeys that indicate something similar, just to help you make sure you're understanding that paradigm. First, look at the receptive fields in the hand. They're normally limited to one digit. You know, we have good acuity in our fingers, and the monkey has the same. And when you record from units in the hand area of the cortex, you normally get responses just on one digit. But if you train them in a task where repeatedly they have to grasp a bar and, you know, move the bar, and they have to grasp it in a certain way like this. So multiple digits are touching the bar, both the distal part of the hand and the more proximal part of the hand when they grasp the bar. And they're trained, not just for many trials a day, but over many days. When they do that for a long time, then they get many cells with these multi-digit receptive fields. Those kinds of cells weren't there before. Okay? So, has there been rewiring? Has it been sprouting? This just shows a map. I think this is the one I put in the book. The multi-digit receptive fields in the distal part of the hand, distal part of the fingers, and the more proximal part of the fingers are represented by the red and the blue colors. Okay? And if you look at a normal, there's almost none of that. But in these trained animals, the cortex changes considerably in the nature of its receptive fields. Okay. And you could argue that it's quite possible that these are, those such connections did exist, but then they're increasing a lot in strength, so now we can record their effects. Other people have thought that there might be anatomical changes, but it's been difficult to get any real evidence that that's happening. Okay, now these are just additional questions that you should be able to think about from what we've talked about and what you've read about. We've already mentioned today about changes going on in those superficial layers 2 and 3. We think for hippocampus, the input to the hippocampus that provides the hippocampus information about local environments, remembers, and the hippocampus then in forming long-term memories, for long-term memories to be retained, they can't stay in the hippocampus. We think most of that's happening in the parietal association areas, the multimodal areas. And we think the changes are likely now from the recent work to be in those superficial layers. But so far, you know, there's not been studies of just how stable those changes are that they observe in layers 2 and 3. When they just look at them, they seem to be changing a lot. But when you get a long-term memory forming, we know that these memories, they might change some, but they change it a little bit when you're sleeping. But in fact, you retain some things very, very well over a very long term. And we don't understand exactly how that's happening and why some things are more transient even in the neocortex and some are not. So I just talked a little bit about other areas of plasticity, and especially here, we've talked about it a bit in the corpus striatum, and that includes not just the ventral tegmentary, the ventral striatum, but the dorsal striatum. Both of them involve the dopamine projections. It happens in the cerebellum, at least shorter term memories in the hippocampus. And then in the brainstem, even in the colliculus, even the shorter term habituation, sensitization, those are a type of memory. You have it in all sensory systems. And then we know working memory, which is also transient, happens in the prefrontal cortex, but it also now happens, there's recent data here at MIT, Andrew Bolden's thesis work, that indicates it's happening in the midbrain tectum as well. And it's only in recent years that these kinds of learning have been found to be associated with anatomical changes as well. Okay, I'm not going to go through. Just remember, everything is not plastic. The basic pattern we've talked about in this class is pretty much the same in all members of a species. Maybe in humans, if you look at the details, you're always going to find differences. And some of those differences are genetic. They run in families. That's another finding out of that Moscow group. You know, like the ipsilateral pyramidal trait. Some families have it, some families don't. The massa intermedia, same thing. Some families have it crossing the midline there, and other the ventricles found there. Okay, but these are differences, and we know there's sex differences as well. And a lot of that develops postnatally. It's, some of it's genetic, some of it is due to the hormonal effects on development, as we talked about. Okay. So anyway, I talk a little bit about things, my conclusions about the cortex, and the important role, what did I do here? The important role of the ability we have to anticipate and to plan the major innovation of the neocortex, sometimes neglected. Yeah, acuity, fine motor control, that's very important too. But it's what came later, the development of ability to plan those movements, you know, and to use that sensory information for anticipating events. That's, I think, been the major innovation, and that has involved subcortical structures too, especially structures like the hippocampal formation, as we've talked about. All right, so then I just talk about some of the things that I think we need more. We need a lot more work on a lot of this, as I pointed out. So, I hope you are finishing that last chapter, and I hope the class and the book help you get at least an outline of the whole central nervous system in your minds. So in the future, if you encounter, it's more you're adding to that outline. If you don't have the outline, it's very difficult even to retain what you're learning about the brain. I found that when I studied with Nauta, and I never lost that picture of the brain I developed at that time. a picture I did not really have at all, or it was a very distorted one before I studied it more formally. So that's basically what I was trying to do in this book, to help a lot more people other than my class at MIT do that. So anyway, you're my keepers. I'm really thankful that you stayed with it. And I hope you all do really well in the exam. I'll be happy if you all get A's. Okay? I posted the review. And I know it's a lot of questions. If you have some of it seems foreign to you, you can't find it. Just ask. Okay? And I will check that forum frequently. If any of you actually decide to use it, it actually works. And some years I get a lot of exchange with students. But what I will do now, I do want you to review your midterm exam, but I'm not going to post any more questions based on the midterms, the pre-midterm classes. Okay. Only the things that occurred after the midterm. But do look at the midterm itself. And, but all I do is I take that review sheet. I don't always repeat the question exactly because sometimes I think it's a little too big or something. And I've highlighted words in there that might be, I might ask you to define. Just to help you figure out, well, what words might he ask? Well, I've highlighted them there. And there could be other words that are involved in the figures than I've shown you, figures I want you to pay special attention to. I do that because, you know, I might put a figure on the exam, like I did for the midterm, and you indicate a few of the labels, things like that. You all did well in the midterm, so this exam will be very similar. Okay?